The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good evening, this is Anna Kogal from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the February issues of Glamour Magazine and Vogue Magazine. I'm also going to be reading a little excerpt from Do You Know What Day Today, Tomorrow Is? Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached by kiwanisfoundation.org. Well, welcome back, everyone. I hope you're enjoying your February and this winter weather that we're having, although it has been a little bit warmer and rainier. All right, well, today is February 8th, but yesterday was February 7th, and February 7th happens to be the birthday of somebody you might have read in your childhood days, the birth date of Laura Ingalls Wilder, who wrote the popular Little House books. She was a pioneer for stories for middle grade readers based on her own life growing up on the American frontier in the late 19th century. She began the series when she was 65. Wow. The first title, Little House in the Big Woods, was followed by Farmer Boy, Little House on the Prairie, On the Banks of Plum Creek, By the Shores of Silver Lake, The Long Winter, Little Town on the Prairie, and These Happy Golden Years, all published by Harper and Row and available in paperback. Well, maybe those brought back some memories. Also, on February 7th, so yesterday, in 1812, Charles Dickens was born in Portsmouth, England. A bright youngster, he learned to read and write at an early age, but when he was 11 years old, his education was held back because his father was imprisoned for owing money. Young Dickens had to work in a factory to help support his family. The cruel treatment and harsh living conditions he endured were vividly remembered and recreated in his writings. Later, when his father inherited money, he was sent to a boarding school. In his late teens, he became a newspaper reporter in Parliament and soon rose to the top of his profession. His fame as a writer began with the publication of Pickwick Papers in 1837 and continued with such works as A Tale of Two Cities, Oliver Twist, David Copperfield, and Great Expectations, many of which are thought to contain incidents based on his early life experiences. A Christmas Carol, first published in 1843, features the greatest people hater of all times, Scrooge. And it has become a favorite Christmas story. And there is an edition of this classic that has been illustrated by Caldecott Award winner Trina Shart Hyman. That's a really beautiful one. Anyway, just thought you might want to know these things. And actually, on February 8th, 1823, was the birth date of Jules Verne. Ships that could travel underwater, vehicles that could fly to the moon, these are things that astounded 19th century readers when Jules Verne wrote about them. Born in France, he became a writer who laid much of the foundation for modern science fiction. A prolific author, he was popular around the world for his fantasies. So maybe you have read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or Around the World in 80 Days or even Journey to the Center of the Earth. And a lot of these became very successful motion pictures. So what kind of futuristic ideas do you have? And maybe you could write something about what you think the future is going to be looking like. Anyway, those are some of the items that happened yesterday and today, many years ago. Well, I'm going to start right off with something that's coming right up, right around the corner, the Olympics. And this is from the Glamour magazine. It's entitled, I Just Want to Be the Best. Nine Olympic medal hopefuls chronicle their dramatic paths to the 2018 Winter Games in Pyongyang, South Korea, this month. Get ready to cheer. And this is by Christina Goyens. And there's a picture of half-pipe favorite Chloe Kim as she trains on Mammoth Mountain in California. And she is a snowboarder. Well, half-pipe, obviously. Okay. Becoming an Olympian is not just about the hours spent training, though that helps. It requires drive. Insane, unmatched drive. The women on these pages, all likely to compete in Pyongyang, have that determination. For example, at age 13, snowboarder Chloe Kim was already competing like an Olympic medal contender. She placed second at the women's halfpipe qualification that year and would have gone to the Sochi Games, except that rules required athletes to be at least 15 to compete. Now 17, Kim is poised to dominate the halfpipe, her significant event. If she does, she'll be the youngest American snowboarder ever to win an Olympic medal. The pressure, she admits, is hard, but mostly I see it as positive that people see potential in me. And she adds, like a true teenager, I'm excited to make memories with my friends. I've heard the food and shopping are amazing in South Korea. Her journey to the top has required sacrifices. Kim combined her junior and senior years, graduating last May, missing things like senior prom, to focus on her training. It was hard to balance, she says. I'd come home after 3 to 5 hours of snowboarding and sit down to do schoolwork the rest of the day. It was my parents' idea to finish early. I can't thank them enough. She still logs tons of time on the board and hits the gym 3 days a week, but she keeps it fun. The longest I've been in the gym was 2 hours. About 65% of that time, I was on my phone, eating Oreos, she says. Kim's plan for Pyongyang, keep it simple. When she was 15, she became the second snowboarder ever, after Shaun White, and the first woman to land back-to-back 1080s in competition and earn a perfect score. She decided not to mess with that. Is it worth learning a new trick that I might not land when it matters most? Or could I just make everything I have look flawless? I went with flawless. All right, the U.S. Women's National Hockey Team. We want to change the way the world sees women's hockey. And, so it says, this is by Hillary Knight. Last March, in the U.S. Women's National Hockey Team, nearly missed the world championships. Ranked number one in the world, they almost boycotted the big game after more than a year of demanding fair wages to no avail. We had a vision, and the only way to see it through was to remain united, says forward Megan Duggan, 30. After tough negotiations, including one phone call that lasted 8 hours, the women struck a deal with USA Hockey. Both sides agreed to keep the details confidential, but ESPN reported the raise took each player from a small stipend to about $70,000 per player per year for the next 4 years with performance bonuses. 10 days after negotiations ended, the team walked away with its 7th world championship. This deal transcended our sport, says Hillary Knight, 28, a forward. Women's hockey is now part of a conversation that is changing the way the world sees women. After everything these women have been through in the past year, the roster now feels like a family. Being able to have 22 sisters to lean on for everything is what makes being a champion athlete on a team sport so special, says forward Brianna Decker, 26. The team especially loves the hour they spend together each week not training. They never miss an episode of This Is Us. One of the coolest parts of this year is that we've become almost inseparable, says Knight. Now, to prep for South Korea, the team skates for nearly 2 hours together every day. then hits the gym for up to 3 hours of strength training with moves like dumbbell presses, push-ups, bridges, and box jumps. That's 35 hours a week, or more than 1,000 hours of training, during the October to May season. The Olympics are just one tournament on their busy schedule. Make no mistake, these are some seriously strong women. Winning the negotiation gave us confidence on and off the ice about who we are as players, women, and leaders, says Knight. But winning a gold medal, having a tangible success to show everyone who supported our team, would mean so much to us. All right, skiing has been therapy for me. Oksana Masters, Paralympic Nordic skier. And she is shown in a picture here with two artificial legs. Oksana Masters was 9 when her left leg was amputated due to radiation-induced birth defects caused by the Chernobyl nuclear disaster in her native Ukraine. The surgery came just a year and a half after her mom, Gay, adopted her and brought her to the United States. A few years later, Masters had to say goodbye to her right leg, too. The malformations had become too pronounced to save it. "I was not happy," she says. Masters turned to athletics to help her recovery, joining an adaptive rowing team after a faculty member at her school suggested it. "Sports were a way for me to get comfortable with my body," she says. "I learned to appreciate everything I could still do." Today, the 28-year-old doesn't play just one sport. She competes in 4 Olympic events: biathlon, cross-country skiing, winning a silver and bronze in Sochi, rowing, bronze in London, and hand cycling, 4th and 5th place in Rio. All her sports require massive upper body strength, which she has in spades. "When you're using your upper body to live," she explains, "you get to know how to move every muscle." Skiing was actually the last event Masters began to compete in, though she'd always wanted to play a winter sport. "In 2012, I was invited to a ski event called the Hartford Ski Spectacular to learn how to sit ski for the first time. I loved it, but it was not pretty. I was not good. I didn't know how to stop, so I kept throwing myself on the ground," she says. "But I don't know when to quit. I'm stubborn. Once I start something, I want to see how far I can go." That included getting gear made to help her master the sport. "I sit in a custom-made seat with custom bindings and propel myself forward with my trunk and double poles," she says. Now she's more than ready for South Korea. "I'm going to into this year with confidence, knowing what I can achieve." And finally, the U.S. National Women's Bobsled Team. We spend hours preparing for just 2 minutes. And here's a picture of the sled squad. Evans is the brakeman. Grubel Poser is the pilot. Myers Taylor is the pilot. Carrie Jones is the brakeman. It takes a lot of prep for a single bobsled run, hauling the sled to the start line, setting it up on the track, and hauling it off after the run. So the women's bobsled team has time for only 2 practice races a day. "Racing," says Aja Evans, 29, a brakeman, "is the easiest part. About 4 times a week after practice, each athlete spends several hours at the gym, lifting, or at the track, sprinting. Most of that work is done solo, though. Their pilot-brakeman pairings are not announced until just weeks before the games, which means the current team of 9 must be ready to race with anyone. Our total training time on the ice with our partner will be 1.5 hours," says Elena Myers Taylor, 33, a pilot, making matters more complicated. In 2015, the governing body of the sport required teams to shave 33 pounds off their maximum weight, which includes the 365-pound sled. We had to lean up, says Evans, who shed 10 pounds after the rule change. The team now carefully fine-tunes their food and fitness choices to retain every ounce of muscle to help push the sled. Myers Taylor aims to eat 1,700 calories a day, which may seem low for a pro athlete, but it's my sweet spot, she says. Jamie Grubel Poser, 34, a pilot, eats 2,000 to 3,000 calories a day. Most women on the team have very different bodies, so everyone is always gaining or losing to meet in the middle and be within weight range of any partner. Talk about getting to know your teammates. All right, our next story is from Vogue magazine, the February issue. Have you ever thought of, had the idea that, oh, wouldn't it be cool to, like, restore a home, like a little cottage or something, and just kind of make it your own? Would you put a garden in it or flowers? Maybe you've written something like this. I don't know. I think I have, to be honest. Well, this story is called Happy Valley. Alexis and Trevor Traina restored a 100-year-old kit house. That means you get a kit and you have to put it together, walls and everything, and grounds to create a nostalgic family idyll in Napa. That's Napa, California. Hamish Bowles reports. And there's a picture of this really cute little cottage with gray paneling on the front and a little dormer right in the middle above the front door on the second floor with the window open. And it's got a porch on either side of the front door. You can see stairs are leading up to the second floor when you walk in. The front door is open, and the front door, by the way, has all glass divided into, what is that, 15 panes of glass. And there's a girl and a boy kind of running with their dog wanting to go in, and they've got like shrubbery all over. And on that picture, it says, "Finding Neverland, we wanted it to feel very Napa of another time," says Alexis of her home, "but always inspired and theatrical." Johnny and Delfina Traina and dog Tony are the boys, is the boy and the girl. All right, so, oh, this is really nice. You would love it, I think. There is a picture of a bedroom with golden walls and some pictures on the one of the walls, and a bed with big fluffy white pillows, and then it looks like the sheets are a lilac, have some lilacs on them, so purple and then lighter pink and white. And it looks really very inviting. And the bathroom has some black and white wallpaper on it, and then a footed tub, and it's got a big window that's open, and the wallpaper, yeah, is like a square black and white. Kind of neat. All right. Alexis Traina's childhood vision of Napa's famed wine country was shaped by the Friday evenings she spent glued to the television watching Falcon Crest. "I was mesmerized by it," Alexis remembers of the campy soap opera starring Ronald Reagan's first wife, Jane Wyman, as the Machiavellian matriarch of a winemaking dynasty, and heartthrob Lorenzo Lamas as her playboy grandson. At the same time, after successful careers in television, radio, and newspapers, Alexis's father, Clark Swanson, who had been drawn to Napa since he first discovered it as a student at Stanford, decided to reinvent himself as a vintner. He and his wife, the flamboyant New Orleanian Elizabeth Pipes, bought a 100-acre parcel on the fecund Oakville Appalachian, or Appalachian. Unlike the screen version, as Alexis recalls, the Napa of 1983 was not shiny, not glossy. It was just beautiful and super sleepy, a true agrarian society. All the wineries had tiny little tasting rooms. It was very simple, humble, and pure. She grew to relish the tapestry of wild, interwoven tribes of multi-generational families, as well as farmers and winemakers and chefs, all drawn together to create magic. Alexis documents the valley she loves and its colorful denizens in her engaging new book, From Napa with Love, Who to Know, Where to Go, and What Not to Miss. Her mother says, her mother made sure that life was about celebrating the little ceremonies and rituals of the dinner table to the maximum. As children, we were expected to participate with gusto. Shay the Swansons, gatherings generally ended with late-night tap dancing. The bohemian Mama Swanson raided Goodwill for interesting footwear, to which she added taps so that all her guests could join in. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to her, Alexis's future husband, startup entrepreneur Trevor Traina, lived about a mile down the road, his parents having acquired and restored the farmhouse of the storied Toe Callon Vineyard, created in the late 19th century by H.W. Crabb, with two B's, the original, quote, wine king, end quote. For her and Trevor, she notes, Napa was always a happy place we shared. After graduation, she went to work with her family, laterally as the creative director of the now-celebrated Swanson Vineyards. They were sold 2 years ago, but in the meantime, Trevor had sleuthed a rustic compound based around an honest-to-goodness craftsman Sears kit house of the sort that sprang up all across America at the turn of the century. Its original clapboard water tower was shaded by an ancient oak, with a tack house and vegetable gardens running alongside a train track that carries the whistling Napa Valley wine train, a period-perfect collection of vintage Pullman cars. Like my father, says Alexis, Trevor has an extraordinary nose for finding special places that other people aren't sure what to do with. So many people had overlooked it, but we thought that it would be amazing for our kids and friends, a kind of glorified grown-up camp living. The Trinas called on their old friend, San Francisco decorating impresario Ken Folk, to transform the interiors. We share a joie de vivre, a romantic idea about the world, says the dapper Folk, and a wonderful sense of nostalgia. The trio collaborated Long-Suffering Fishing Camp, a run-down hippie compound set dramatically over the Pacific on the cliffs of Inverness. The multitasking Folk has also created parties for the Trinas, whose hospitality is legendary. Witness the Hearst Bar he had designed in their turn-of-the-century manse in San Francisco's mistiest heights. And that was built around a Damien Hirst spot painting. The Art Deco-inspired Jacques Adnet bar has become a little canoodling spot, as Folk notes, a real connector and the envy of their neighborhood. He also shares a passion for Napa, which he began exploring some 20 years ago when he first moved to California. Inspired by a landscape that reminded him of his native Virginia, he bought a dilapidated place there and subsequently a hilltop farmstead that he playfully describes as a gay Green Acres. For Folk, the Trinas' new compound had a petticoat junction aspect, a folly that celebrated what we really love about Napa and a way to hold on to something that could readily disappear. They scoured antique shops, fairs, flea markets to furnish it. Ken approaches design like an old theater director, says Alexis, and storytelling is a deep passion for the three of us. The kitchen stacked with transferware plates looks as though Mildred Pierce might bake a pie in it, and Mr. Blandings had installed the rhododendron wallpaper in the living room or the quilts in the guest rooms. The property was too good to be true, and it was just sitting there waiting for a family to enliven it again, says Trevor. What was not to love? The Trina children, Johnny 10 and Delphina 9, relish their rural idyll. Napa has become such an integral place, not just for Trevor and Alexis, but also for the next generation. Says Falk, the children swing in the tree and jump in the pool and ride their bikes, and I think it brings out the childlike sense of wonder in adults as well. The idyll was shaken less than a month after these pictures were taken when the trainers were leaving a restaurant in Yountville to discover that the ridge encircling their valley was ablaze with a curtain of bright orange flames that ran for miles. It was just horrifying. They were witnessing California's deadliest natural disaster since the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. They gathered up their children and fled in the middle of the night. Their property was spared, but we all knew many people between our two valleys who lost homes, says Alexis. In response, the trainers moved swiftly with their neighboring friends to help establish the Napa and Sonoma Relief in partnership with Tipping Point Community to support the low-income neighborhoods hardest hit by the fires. During those 2 weeks of fires, people from every corner of the earth reached out. Everyone who has been moved by the indelible experience of Napa will always have a special attachment to this place. Well, if you have a special place in mind in your head that you want to create, draw it, paint it, write it, think it. See how you might be able to get there. We all have our dreams, and we've got to do everything we can to attain them. Don't give up on your dreams. It's February. Let's enjoy this month. But for right now, we have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Kogal, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached by kiwanisfoundation.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Also, please let me know who you are and what special place you have in your mind. Special place where you might want to live someday. All right. So if you have those comments or questions, again, please call 919-832-5138. Make it a phenomenal week. We'll see you next week, just a day after Halloween, after Valentine's Day.